You're listening to Beyond Bourbon Street, an insider's guide to New Orleans. Beyond Bourbon Street is the podcast where we explore the food, music, culture, places, and people that make New Orleans unique. Whether you are planning a trip, living in New Orleans, or simply wanting a taste of the Crescent City from wherever you are, you've come to the right place. And now, your host, Mark Bologna.
Hey, y'all, this is Mark. Today's show is the second of two episodes that we're doing about Storyville. Back in episode 34, we spoke with Pamela Arsenault, who's going to join us again today, about the Blue Books of Storyville. Pamela's the senior librarian and the rare books curator at the Historic New Orleans Collection in the French Quarter, and she wrote this wonderful book called The Guidebooks to Sin, the Blue Books of Storyville, New Orleans. So if you haven't seen that, you can go to the website at beyondbourbonst.com and check out the links. And certainly I'd encourage you to purchase the book through the Historic New Orleans Collection, either in person or online. But today we're going to pick up that theme and we're going to talk all about Storyville, the history and the people, the music, some of the things that Pamela and I just briefly touched on in the last episode. And I'm joined today not only by Pamela, but by two of her counterparts that are curators here at the museum. One is John Lawrence. How are you, John?
Doing great, thank you.
Thanks for joining us.
You bet.
And next is Eric Seifert. Thanks, Eric, for joining us.
Of course. Very happy to join you and be here.
So we're sitting here today. We're actually on April 5th, which is the opening of a new exhibit at the Historic New Orleans Collection that we'll certainly get into, called Storyville, Madams and Music, and gets into the people, and I had the opportunity to take a look at it. And we're also right on the eve of French Quarter Fest. So I thought it would be a great time to come back and visit with the folks here at the New Orleans Collection, Historic New Orleans Collection, and really give you the listeners a taste of what Storyville might have been like back then and how you can experience a little of it today through the book and the collection. So with that, thanks so much, all of you, for joining me.
And I'd like to be here.
Thanks. It's so good to see you again.
Thank you.
And I'd like to jump in if somebody wants to start and just kind of let's give our listeners a bit of refresh of what was Storyville and how did it come about?
I think one thing to remember is that Storyville, the kind of regulated vice and entertainment district of its day, which ran from 1898 through most of 1917, was an infinitesimally small part of New Orleans. It was barely a dozen blocks, if I'm correct on that, and just has an outsized influence on not only its own time period of operation, but also how we think about New Orleans today. And yes, a handful of blocks on the north side or lakeside of the French Quarter that was set aside by an ordinance in 1897, sponsored principally by Alderman Sidney Story, whose name, I think much to his both chagrin and regret, is associated with the district.
And again, my understanding is that this alderman created this. They were trying to pull the sort of red light activities into a relatively small area. Of course, never did he think he would end up as the namesake of Storyville.
Storyville was something of an experiment in the control of vice. And I want to emphasize here, Storyville was not the first or the only legally established red light district. Virginia City, Nevada, and the Comstock Lode Silver Strike may have been among the first to enact a geographically limiting ordinance in order to control prostitution in that boom town on the western frontier, as early as 1865. Other cities followed suit: Omaha, Nebraska, Waco, and San Antonio, Texas, all had ordinances in place that describe the geographical limits of their prostitution districts. So Storyville has this reputation as being the United States' only legally designated red lights district, but that's not true.
Sure.
I say experiment. For this 20-year period, the idea was that vice was segregated from the rest of the city. And the use of the term segregation here in the early years leading up to the creation of the Story Ordinance in 1897 was the idea of moving all of the vice in the city to this one geographically described area.
Sure.
Outside of which, prostitution and other forms of vice were considered illegal. I say experiment. By the end of the Storyville era, roughly about 20 years, the idea had run its course.
I see.
The new progressives and the rising middle class argued that these contained red light districts were not really effective in either controlling vice or, worse, the idea behind this
sure.
was the control of venereal disease.
I see.
And as the United States enters World War I, it's discovered that a number of recruits are infected with these sexually transmitted diseases. Prostitution became identified as a significant domestic enemy.
I see.
Which led to the ordinance that had to close the district. Mayor Martin Berman was pressured by Secretary of the Navy, Josephus Daniels, to close down Storyville. And indeed, across the nation, any red light district still operating within 5 miles of a military installation was ordered closed. So that's kind of the idea. And getting back to the segregation, at the beginning, the idea was the segregation of vice.
I see.
Towards the end of the era, Jim Crow laws being more and more stringent, the city tried to separate the races of women
right.
working in the Storyville district. So you also had the segregation by race that was happening at towards the end of the Storyville era.
Sure, and we sort of... sort of talking about the back end of the exhibit that you guys have here at the Historic New Orleans Collection, where Eli and I walked through before we came on, and we're looking at you have the picture of the ships, the military ships, mm-hmm. as well as a little bit of description of the segregation by racism in what was sort of known as Black Storyville, right, as I understand it. For the listeners, we have a little bit of a musical soundtrack just faintly in the background, and we were debating if it's not local jazz station WWOZ, and Pamela was just mentioning we should have put in a request list and just had them play some period specific tunes to set the mood. So I'm not sure if you'll hear that in the background, but I certainly hear it. So that's we'll just roll with it. But again, so the councilman, they kind of set this up as sort of a public experiment to see if we can control the vice district. I'd like to set, if we can, maybe Eric or John, a little bit of. Let's take our listeners back. So it's 1897, the turn of the century. What would it look like? What did New Orleans look like in that Storyville area? Because, of course, now there's very few remnants of Storyville.
Sure. So one thing I want to add first about Storyville, too, before I talk a little bit about that area, is that this very much turned into, it's a vice district where there's prostitution and consumption of, from what I understand, a lot of alcohol. But it was also an entertainment district. It was an area where people would go to listen to music and dance, and that was a big part of what was going on in the Storyville district.
So would there be saloons and bars and things like that where live music was
exactly,
played?
Exactly. Lots of saloons, bars, cabarets, honky-tonks, places to listen to music and go dancing. And, of course, this is around the time when recorded sound is just being developed. It's in its infancy. So if you really wanted to go listen to music or dance, you had to do it with live performance. So
sure.
This was you know, an area in town. It wasn't the only area in town you could do that, but it was one that likely had more opportunities to hear music and dance than other places. The Storyville, the area that becomes Storyville, which John mentioned, is the lakeside of Basin Street, just downriver from Canal. Prior to the legislation, was the ordinance enacting Storyville was a mostly working class neighborhood,
okay,
largely African American, but a mixed race mm-hmm. neighborhood. And there were lots of businesses in there as well.
And it was part of the area that would have been known, and to some degree still is today, known as back of town.
Correct. Yeah. And I think that's an important point, is that this back, you know, back of town is very descriptive, right? It
right.
means, you know, it's the city's backyard. It's not what is on public view. It is not necessarily what you want to be advertising as the heart of your city.
Sure.
Right? So it's, and it's also tends to be an area that is less well off. So that's kind mm-hmm. of where they put it. And part of the idea was to push vice, which had, you know, at this point, vice being prostitution, out of the French Quarter, away from the business district and into one confined area in back of town, you know, kind of away from
sure.
away from the eyes of visitors to the city and respectable and well-to-do people. Of course, many respectable and well-to-do people ended up spending a lot of money there, and the location eventually kind of flips and becomes more of an entry point into the city and a financial driver. A lot of money is coming in to that part of town. There's a railway station constructed that opens in 1908 right at Basin and Canal that basically okay. takes you right into the to the entrance of Storyville as you would get off the train, or, you know.
Any thought of marginalization was lost at that point.
At that point.
Right.
So that's interesting. And that are there any remnants of that today? Of this, it was the Southern Railway? Is that what it
became the Southern Railway. I do not know of any architectural elements that exist from there, but they certainly may exist. I just don't know.
So we started by, and again, for our listeners, back of town being the French Quarter was the original town, if you will, coming from the river and Decatur Street and working your way back to the back end that we all know as Rampart Street. So they put Storyville in the back of town, and then we've just undergone a tremendous explosion in population through the 1800s here in New Orleans, right? And so now, as you describe it, for trying to isolate it, we then put a railroad terminus right at the entrance to Storyville, effectively.
Yes, and New Orleans was still certainly, although it had been declining as a population center, post-Civil War, was still the largest, if not one of the largest cities in the South at that time, and was still driven a lot by its role as an entrepot, a place where freight
sure.
is brought and transported elsewhere. In fact, one of the boundaries of Storyville, a boundary close to the edge of Storyville was the Old Basin Canal, which was
right,
still
sure.
an active waterway, bringing goods really to the city's back door, and with breweries, with lumber yards, kind of adjacent to
okay.
the district, you get a sense that this was very much you know, a place that was involved in lots of commercial activity besides those associated with vice and entertainment. New Orleans was about this time also being able to expand toward its interior because of the introduction of the drainage pumps that made
sure.
Draining that very, very low part of the city possible. And so I think affects the character of the city as well. The city had now more of a capacity to move away from its natural levees, both existing on the Mississippi River and on the ridges, Esplanade Ridge, Metairie Ridge,
sure.
Chantilly Ridge, that had kind of indicated former water courses of the river and its tributaries. And then a little bit later, a decade following the closure of Storyville, there would be land reclamation along the lake. So New Orleans was still looking for land to settle people on, and Storyville is kind of in the beginning of this ability to do that at the 20th century's start.
Well, and I think that's interesting, John, as you think about the geography of New Orleans today, essentially from where we're sitting in the French Quarter, there's not really much vacant land between here and Lake Pontchartrain. You know, the city park is probably the widest expanse, and there's a small forest actually in Gentilly, but for the most part, it's developed. But at that time, it was still going through sort of, it was far from the developed area we see now. I mean, obviously that we had spread uptown and into Carrollton and out towards the lake, but there was plenty of more rural land. But it's,
yes.
Go ahead.
No, I think that's true. And what Eric had talked about the railroad coming right into downtown at Canal and Basin, was also indicative of sort of New Orleans's prominence as a rail hub. Certainly, it was not the only rail hub in the South, but you had trains coming and going from many different places, and to the point that much later in the century, all of these, at least passenger rail lines, were consolidated into a single facility, Union Passenger Station or Passenger Terminal, that accommodated all of that rail travel, but still a very, very busy cargo, rail handling of cargo that was meant not only for distribution to the American interior west and east, but also on boats that were heading out of the port.
So if someone arrives, whether they arrive by ship or train at that time, and they end up right near Storyville, either by choice or accident, it's a very lively, busy, bustling place that you all describe.
Well, probably depends a little bit on what time you get there, too. But yeah, especially at night, it really would have been. I don't know. I guess, Pamela, do you want to talk a little bit about Basin Street and some of the activities going on in those first blocks?
We were mentioning what the neighborhood was like before, and for the most part, the houses that you see in the Storyville district at this time are pretty much the houses that were there before. However, along Basin Street and a couple of other places within the district, enterprising madams constructed elaborate brothels, places like the Arlington, managed by Josie Arlington, Mahogany Hall, perhaps the most famous of the mansions, managed by Lulu White. And then there was the Star Mansion, under the guidance of Miss Ray Owens. These were elaborately furnished places. They're described in the Blue Books, almost along the lines of a not-to-be-missed educational experience, like visiting an art museum. And, oh, by the way, there is commercial sex available. These top-of-the-line houses catered only to white men.
I see.
Other houses, more working class, and certainly towards the back of the district, men of both races could visit. That sort of thing. And we talk about the mansions. There are the second-tier houses, third-tier, perhaps.
Sure.
And then at the very bottom are the cribs. These are narrow one- or two-room hovels, shacks almost, that women who are living outside the district would rent in order to ply their trade. And they often worked in shifts, under terrible conditions, and these places, though you can see them on the maps of the district, they're not mentioned in Blue Book, which, of course, was promoting a glamorous destination for the visitor.
Sure, they,
and,
right.
The cribs don't contribute to this sort of aura of the elite that the marketers of Storyville are trying to promote. But these fantastic brothels, the Arlington, the Star, Hilma Burt's, the the Mahogany Hall, featured fantastically decorated parlors, dens, each representing a theme, the Turkish den, the Japanese den, the Chinese exotica, things that would not be experienced by the usual visitor to New Orleans, perhaps. Most of these places had ballrooms. Many of them had mirrored ballrooms, which was certainly an eye-popping feature for visitors to see. Many of the houses themselves, even the fabulous mansions from the outside, look pretty similar to the architecture of the day.
And
largely Queen Anne with turrets and balconies and all sorts of architectural decorations. So they are not so unusual themselves. It's what's inside. The way they're decorated. Most residences didn't have mirrored ballrooms at that time. Many of the brothels, of course, would have live musicians. The better houses would have at least a piano player, sometimes a small combo. The more working-class houses might have a hand-cranked gramophone.
Sure.
And we will have that on display. We have a piano from the era
right.
on display here, as well as a mirrored panel from the Arlington's Mirrored Music and Ballroom. One of the few fragments of these fabled brothels that exist, because they're all gone now.
Right, and that's a great segue into the actual exhibit here at the Historic New Orleans Collection. The name of the exhibit is Storyville Madams and Music, and we've just touched on a bunch of it, but if a visitor comes to see, and you can see a little bit of it online, obviously, but I saw just before we came in, there are fragments of the mirrored room from one of the great, I say great houses. Obviously, there's this undercurrent of what we're talking about here. We're talking about prostitution, right. And but very elaborate. You all have some really interesting artifacts down in the exhibit.
Yes, I think when people can see elements of the material culture, it sort of places their ability to imagine this in a different realm. And although there are scattered artifacts of the buildings and their interiors around, it's they are perhaps hiding in plain sight, but they are not very well known to a large public. And when you consider one of the items that we have in there is just a newspaper announcement about auctioning the contents of one of the mansions, and you know, the dozens of mirrors and 100 sofas or 12 p.m. whatever the
it is sort of staggering.
You get the sense of not only the opulence that Pamela was talking about, but just almost encrusted with fine furniture and expensive adornment. And I'm sure that there are those in people's houses, maybe known or unknown to them, of the origin. But it's really to me a great mystery as to why there is so little of that physical residue pertaining to Storyville.
Well, I think that point you make, John, we're upstairs down in the exhibit, this sort of fragment of a newspaper ad, I think it was from Lulu White's, if I remember correctly.
The auction sale.
The auction.
The Mahogany Hall, plus her saloon next door, a portion of which still stands. Exactly. One of the most spectacular pieces in the exhibit is the fanlight. Mm-hmm. That was over the main entrance to Mahogany Hall.
And it really brings to life, and you talk about it in your book, and certainly visitors can see some exhibits about it. But when you see those fragments, you know, some of the pictures are grainy, they're older, they're black and white. And then when you see something in person and you try to imagine this room full of mirrors, or as you were saying, John, that notice of a sale, it reminded me an awful lot of estate sales of uptown mansions today here in the Garden District.
Sure. Yeah.
Just the sheer quantity and the description.
Exactly.
And that's not something that certainly I would associate or that people would think of when you're trying to, I'm thinking about the strip clubs on Bourbon Street today, which I won't grace by naming, right? They certainly aren't opulent in any way. But certainly the ads and some of the fragments that you have here give off that this very much must have been a place that they were trying to advertise as upscale and trying to display by the furnishings.
And part of that was the music, too, that was there. And this is a great legacy that we still have from Storyville.
Yeah, and I would love to talk about that. In the episode with Pamela, we talked about there's sort of maybe a myth, maybe you can help clarify, Eric. It's probably not fair to portray Storyville as the birthplace of jazz. But it certainly was a hotbed of music and collaboration.
Yeah, I think that that's spot on. I think that's a great way to put it. What we try to do in the exhibit is use the boundaries of Storyville geographically and temporally to have a conversation about music and music of the period. And we know this is a time when music was changing. Mm-hmm. Right around the period of Storyville is when jazz was starting to emerge and come out of New Orleans. So what we do is talk about the different musicians and venues. And I already mentioned a little bit how there are all these places you could go hear music and dance to music in the district and talk about what these musicians were playing.
Sure.
Depending on where you were, you'd hear different things. And going back to this discussion of opulence, the brothels on Basin Street were selling opulence. They're selling luxury, among other things, exoticism.
Sure.
But there was a lot of variety in the district too. And there was probably whatever you had to pay in your pocket, you could probably find something to spend it on. So, I mean,
sure.
Certain places were more exclusive, but that wasn't all that was there. And we talked about the Cribs a little bit earlier. If you look through the maps of the period, you can see how many of these Cribs there were, and there were many more Cribs than there were brothels. It would be interesting to see if there were more women working in Cribs than in the brothels. I don't know. The brothels often housed a number of women. So, but it's interesting to see the variety.
Yeah.
And you'd have the same thing with music. So in the brothels on Basin Street, typically you would have a piano player, and they would be what we've kind of been calling a human jukebox. They needed to play whatever these patrons wanted to hear. And these people were men of means, coming to spend a lot of money on alcohol and prostitution.
Right.
And needed to make sure that the piano player could play what this person, a number of women worked in the brothels as piano players as well, needed to be fairly vast. Most of them were able to read and sight read music, and sometimes brought their own music. Others could pick up songs very quickly. We know one of them, Tony Jackson, is said to be able to play anything by ear after hearing it once. And some of the music they played, like I said, opera overtures to ragtime songs to popular Tin Pan Alley hits. So really a wide range. One of the things we have in the exhibit that I think is really interesting is a collection of sheet music from one of the professors, professors being piano players in the brothels. His name is Manuel Mineta, and there's a collection of his sheet music that dates to his career that matches the period of his career as a piano player in the brothels, and a lot of it is classical music. So on display, we have an image of him, and then some of his sheet music, which includes Poet and Peasant Overture, which is a very popular opera overture of the period, William Tell, some Beethoven. So you can get a sense, Chopin. Yeah, you can see really the variety. And then if you round the corner of the exhibit, we have created somewhat of a frieze of popular sheet music covers from the period. And Pamela and I went through and we picked out a cover of a piece of sheet music that was popular for each year of the district's existence. So there's one from 1897 up through 1917, and you see things, you know, from a cakewalk up through ragtime, lots of ragtime, and, you know, all the different popular one steps and two steps, and then you get by the very end, there the word jazz appears on the last piece of sheet music in 1917. So it you kind of see the variety there too.
It's sort of like a hit parade for that 20-year Storyville period. And the sheet music covers are really striking. There'll be some pieces that are still familiar to people today. Alexander's Ragtime Band, one, and Pretty Baby.
Didn't he ramble?
Oh, didn't he ramble?
Maple Leaf Rag,
absolutely.
People will recognize a lot of those pieces.
One of the things that struck me, and certainly in our previous discussion, Pamela, you and I talked about the idea that it was far more than ragtime. And even as a native New Orleanian, I sort of bought into the sort of stereotype or myth that it was ragtime and jazz. But those covers downstairs do a wonderful job of showing the variety that you talk about, Eric.
Well, and one of the things, we have some oral histories down there too, from musicians that played in the district. One of them is from General Morton. And he says in this little bit, he plays some opera and then he starts talking and he says, "You can play anything in jazz time if you know what you're doing." And I think that's one of the things that you can take from this period of the change in music, is that what they're doing is not is playing music a certain way. So you can play opera, you can take an opera melody and play it as jazz.
Sure.
If you incorporate certain jazz elements. And this is a thing jazz musicians have done throughout the 20th century. If you think back about all the different popular songs that musicians have reinterpreted with by adding jazz elements. So they're doing the same thing then. They're taking popular songs and tunes that people would know, like opera overtures or classic just Americana songs, and adding elements to them. And when and how they're doing that, we're not totally sure. My guess is when Jelly Roll and some of these guys are playing in a brothel and they're working, right? They're at work.
Sure,
they're going to most likely be playing from the page what the person wants to hear. And I think kind of after hours, when you're among musicians, is when kind of the experimentation really would have been going on, which, you know, again, is how a lot of music works today. You play to your audience, and then when your audience is other musicians, you kind of try to one up them and pull out all the stops, and a lot of the evolution of the music, I think, happens at that point.
And it strikes me that's very much a part of New Orleans music culture today, right? In clubs throughout the city, and even on the corners here in the in the French Quarter with the buskers. People are tourists come and ask for very specific things,
right.
And as soon as that is done, you hear this collaboration and improvisation and turning, and even the WWOZ that I'm assuming I hear in my head right now, right? So much of exactly what you describe, it's taking what has now become sort of that syncopated beat here in New Orleans that any of us that have been here any amount of time think of the meters and can hear it, and that starts to riff through different kinds of music. And what I hear you describing is that's the same thing that was happening there.
Right.
I think one.
Go ahead.
I think one of the things that is sort of goes hand in hand with what Eric and Pamela have said about the music, and they can speak to this more than I can. But the fact that there's a lot of dancing going on as well,
sure.
and that is reflected also in the sheet music covers where it says this is a two-step, this is a foxtrot, this is a novelty dance, and we don't shy away from, talking about that as part of the exhibition.
Sure.
There are video clips of people demonstrating four different dances.
I think we have five.
Five dances.
Okay.
And so that is part of it too. And it also, as Eric and Pamela can, again, elaborate more, phonograph machines were also marketed as ways to learn these dances at home. So you would be ready for your public debut when you went out to Storyville or elsewhere. I just wanted to point out that the music and the dance in some ways go hand in hand, and we sort of reinforce that point in certain areas of the exhibition.
It very much comes out in the exhibition as you're walking through. You can see not only the covers, but you have the music playing in the background. You have the different examples of the piano and some pictures there. It really does come to life. I think it sort of does start to bring that picture to life for you of what you might have seen. I'd like to talk a little bit about, so clearly besides a music area, this was an area of prostitution. And these were real people represented there. There were women, obviously, and men that worked there. You guys, I think, in the exhibit start to bring that to life, and there are photos of some folks that worked there and the women, and obviously it could not have been a good life for those women, but what was life like?
Thank you, Mark. Like most vice districts, the population is pretty fluid. It's constantly, there's a flow in and out. So the actual population of the district is ever changing.
I see.
Also, there are seasonal differences. Of course, the busiest time was during the carnival season or leading up to carnival, during the winter months where you have more visitors to the city, and then it slacks off as the weather gets warm, pretty much what our cycle is now. And these changes were reflected in a number of particularly the larger brothels where the madams would bring on more women in anticipation of more activity during heavier trafficked times, and then would let some go when there wasn't as much business. And also, women were constantly coming through and leaving.
Sure.
So you have women who would work in the district for a while, and then they'd take the riverboat, go up to Memphis, go up to St. Louis, Cincinnati, or they'd take the train and go over to Pensacola, or they'd go out to California.
I see.
So there is it's not a static community.
Sure.
And in fact, sometimes it's noted that madams would send out notices to particular patrons to let them know that the spring fashions have arrived, meaning that they have taken on some new women.
Hmm.
So there is a panel in the exhibit where we show 9 faces of women. The photographs of them are on loan to us from the New Orleans Public Library, which is also the New Orleans City Archives. And these are New Orleans Police Department arrest photographs.
Oh,
and there are cards called Bertillon cards that give the arrest information for each of these women. These are all women who worked in the district. None of them, of course, are arrested for prostitution because prostitution is legal at the time.
Sure.
They are arrested for assorted crimes, robbery, assault, creating a disturbance.
I see.
Suspicious person is what's written on the reason for arrest on the card for some of these women. But their faces do give you an idea of the women who worked in the district. Numerous women are listed in the blue books in the directory section.
Sure.
A lot of those names may well be aliases or pseudonyms.
Sure.
Some of the arrest cards for these women will give a name that they gave the officer when they were arrested, but there's also a listing in some cases of these women's aliases.
Sure.
So that sort of gives you pause too. We don't want to glorify prostitution in the exhibit because it really was a very hard life then and now.
Sure.
And the images of these women, which is also included in a page in Guidebooks to Sin, give you the sense of the reality, the faces of the women who actually worked in the district.
That's one of the things that struck me in walking through the collection earlier today is the seeing the photos, both the photos you described, the arrest photos, as well as there's a couple of
Ernest Belloc.
Belloc, and I was going to ask you about that. Maybe we should describe for our listeners who Ernest Belloc was.
Ernest Belloc was a commercial photographer based in New Orleans. He was born in 1878, died in 1949. And you can piece together some biography of him through his commercial pictures, which included everything from First Communion portraits to views of architecture and dock construction on the New Basin Canal. And these pictures of the women of, who worked in Storyville have been associated with him for the better part of 50 years. There is certainly strong evidence or some strong evidence to connect him with the creation of these pictures, which were principally known in negative form, but none of them are signed, and there's still a lot of faith on the oral tradition that these are these pictures are by him. They were printed prints of them prior to their acquisition by Lee Friedlander from the New Orleans owner in their middle 1960s do exist. Again, those are not provable to be from Belloc's hand.
Sure.
And most of what people know of his work has come from the exhibitions and publications that have been done under Lee Friedlander's agency and ownership of these pictures since the late 1960s.
They do strike me when you see them, again, downstairs in the collection here at the Historic New Orleans Collection. And again, the name of the exhibit is Storyville, Madams, and Music. But it does, one of the things that's striking about those photos is that there certainly are, there are images of women who are nude and posed on chaise lounges and that sort of thing. But there are many more that I've seen that are just depicting them in sort of ordinary life in their workspace, if you will. And it is, as you describe, there's nothing glamorous about it. And I think trying to look backwards through the view of today, of 2017, it does sort of give you this stark and give you a sense of this was, you know, it may have been presented as glamorous for the patron, but it was anything but for the women who worked there.
I think that's an accurate perception.
And that's what struck me walking through just earlier. I had seen the arrest photographs from your book, Pamela, but to see them sort of right there along with the somewhat more stylized Belloc photos, mm-hmm. together, it actually makes it more striking to me of there was nothing glamorous about that, obviously, for the women who worked there.
Right. There's certainly a different type of transaction between the photographer and the subject in those two groups of photographs.
Sure.
People photographed by the police probably had no choice in the matter.
And, fair enough.
And those taken by Belloc were probably complicit in the dialogue between
and they
the
do
photographer
seem at
and
ease
subject.
In those pictures.
They certainly do not look like they're being hauled up on a charge.
Right.
The sort of piercing stare that you get from the subjects from the arrest records.
That's one of the things that's striking to me walking through the exhibit is that, again, being from New Orleans and knowing a little bit and certainly having read Pamela's book and gotten to speak to her, in the just walking through the exhibit, you really do, I think it does a great job of bringing it to life. You talked about Basin Street and the train terminus there. There's a model downstairs that kind of gives you a picture of what that might look like. And then the music covers, as well as the music playing, the pictures. There's also some testimonials from some of the musicians. I think you mentioned Eric.
We've got a few oral histories from piano players that played in some of the brothels. We've got three, in fact, one from Jelly Roll Morton, who I'm sure many people are familiar with, one from Rosalind Johnson, and one from Manuel Mineta, who people might be less familiar with. Those both of them worked in the brothels as well, and Mineta. Is a well-known New Orleans first-generation jazz musician. He worked in the brothels. He also was a multi-instrumentalist and taught music over in Algiers across the river,
yep.
where he lived after he retired from performance in the early 1920s. So those oral histories are neat to listen to. They talk about their life in the district, kind of the working environment. They play a little music that was popular at the time. Rosalind Johnson in particular goes into great detail about life at Lulu White's Mahogany Hall, which is really interesting to hear her talk about how it was a really high class joint and, no swearing or there'd be a $5 fine, no smoking or a $10 fine, something, you know,
sure.
all these kind of ways that I think the madams curated the experience for the patrons. And then of course they talk about how only the wealthiest men would be able to go into these brothels. We also have, and that's specifically the ones on Basin Street, we also have written testimony. Again, Jelly Roll Morton shows up, a letter he wrote about his experiences in the
right.
district, I think from around 38. So a good 20 years later, and one from 1947 years later, and Louis is born around the turn of the century. He grows up in the uptown Storyville area, the black Storyville area,
sure.
And really grows up in this environment, has a chance to listen to some of the music by sneaking around the clubs, has a barbershop quartet as a kid where he gets into Storyville and sings. And children were not allowed in Storyville, and
sure.
a lot of these young musicians, guys like Armstrong and Bechet, who were young at the time, talk about going in and having to watch out for the policemen who would chase them away with their billy sticks. But he would break in and he'd listen to music. He delivered coal to some of the women working there. And he said, you know, I deliver coal and then linger as long as I could to hear the music coming out of these places. So he was very influenced musically by his childhood in this area. And so he talks about that in an article that was published in True Magazine in 1947. So we were able to share some of these first-person testimonies of experiences in the district, which of course were done quite a bit later, but give you another entry point into what life was like there.
Well, I certainly think for music lovers and for New Orleans music lovers who visit the city, or maybe people that are here, coming to see the exhibit, you'll get different things out of it. So certainly you'll learn about the prostitution through the blue books and the houses and the photos, but you get a musical history of New Orleans there. You mentioned Algiers. We did an earlier episode of Beyond Bourbon Street all about Algiers Point. Mm-hmm. And you can take a walking tour over there and see some of the, at least the exteriors of houses where some of the jazz greats of New Orleans lived. It also struck me in looking at the exhibit that this idea of, say, Louis Armstrong sneaking in, that's always been present in New Orleans culture, right? If you think about lots of the musicians today, Trombone Shorty comes to mind, Harry Connick Jr. comes to mind with his, you know, with his dad sneaking into clubs, or, you know, because his dad's playing, they're going to allow him in. There's a long storied tradition, if you will, in New Orleans of musicians sneaking in to places that they probably technically shouldn't be. And yet that's why you get, I think, these relatively young musicians who already have a decade of...
It's a great way to learn, too.
Exposure and experience.
And, Louis loved King Oliver, Joe Oliver, who eventually brings him up to Chicago. And there are stories of Armstrong following Oliver around when he was parading and waiting for him to take a break and offering to hold his cornet, his instrument. And this was a thing that aspiring young kids would try to do. You'd follow around your idols while they're marching and, you know, rap at their leg and bug them and see if you could hold their instrument for a little while. So this is something that Louis talks about and is another part of this generational kind of way that music is passed on in the city.
I'm struck by the similarity. Again, you know, we're sitting in the French Quarter right on the eve of French Quarter Fest. And you sort of see the French Quarter Fest is really interesting in that it's a free event and it's in the heart of the city in the French Quarter. And you see in the French Quarter all the time young kids wanting to be musicians, or perhaps are musicians, sort of almost at the feet, like you're describing, of people who have made it, whether made it in their eyes is a busker who's successful on a corner or is French Quarter Fest and on a stage, right? And so that same pattern just sort of repeats itself in New Orleans culture. One of the things I do want to mention, we've mentioned the exhibit several times. It just opened on April 5th today, and it runs through December 2nd, I think.
Yes,
December
2nd. That's correct.
So plenty of time for people to come check out. Is there an admission cost to come in to see?
Free of charge.
Free of charge.
Free of charge.
And we're open Tuesday through Saturday, 9:30 to 4:30 at 410 Charter Street at our Williams Research Center.
I think far too many people, including locals, walk by the Historic New Orleans collection and never stop to come in, never stop to see the exhibits and the treasures that you guys have. You have a lot of information online, which I think if you are not here in New Orleans, or even if you are, and you sort of want to whet your appetite, there's plenty there at hnoc.org.
Right, and the website was newly revamped just at the beginning of this week, so... if people have visited before, they might see a different look and hopefully easier navigation.
There's a lot of interaction on the website there, I noticed. One thing, I got a question from a listener who knew I was going to do this, and hopefully this won't be too cringeworthy, but the movie Pretty Baby with Susan Sarandon and a very, very young Brooke Shields, as I understand it, is at least loosely based on the idea of Storyville and Belloc.
Yes, that's right. The idea, and of course, Louis Malle produced his movie in 1978, a few years after the appearance of the Al Rose book, Storyville, New Orleans. One of the characters that Al Rose had interviewed for his book was a woman who had worked as a child as what was called a trick baby. in the business. She was the daughter of a prostitute. The child's name, or what was used as the child's name in the Al Rose interview, was Violet.
Ah.
And she describes what it was like working with her mom and living in one of the high-end houses. This roughly became Pretty Baby.
I see.
The character that Brooke Shields plays is named Violet. Of course, the great controversy of the time is that you have a child actress,
sure,
Brooke Shields, who I believe was 12 years old at the time, in this sexually charged milieu. And there was some, indeed, some consternation about that when the movie came out. So we have on display the poster from the movie and one of the shooting scripts.
At the entrance or right at the exit.
It's one of our last items in the exhibition, and it is sort of an example of how Storyville continued to fire the imagination long after the district had closed. I want to mention something else about Belloc in terms of the Belloc photographs. They were not introduced to the public until the late 60s and early 70s.
Sure.
Belloc seems to have taken these photographs for himself.
Hmm.
They were never distributed. They were never used during the Storyville era as promotional material.
Right, sure.
They seem to have been a private act that he did for himself, photographing these largely unknown women.
Sure. And one last thing that struck me in the exhibit that I would love to ask your opinion on. There's a, right near the end, so 1917 starts to shut down. There's a Eli was pointing out to me, and I should thank Eli for helping put together the interview here. There's a court case. I forget the name of it now, but there's a court case where a madam has sued, essentially about discrimination. Is that right?
Right. So we mentioned the Uptown District or the Black Storyville earlier.
Right.
In the original 1897 ordinance, as it was first written, it was designed to segregate not only Vice, but have two districts segregated by race. This ends up not being part of the actual legislation. I guess it's tabled.
Okay.
So it's not written into the 1897 legislation that goes into effect to start 1898. However, that Uptown District continues, it operates as a quasi-legal prostitution district during the period. There's also, that's kind of where Louis Armstrong grows up and where the Funky Butt is as well. There's about four blocks between Perdido and Gravier. Interestingly enough, right about where our current City Hall is. And so the city kind of turns a blind eye to this area, and it operates through until 1917. At the beginning of that year, the city council has kind of decided that there's too much mixing of the races going on in this Storyville area, and they need to segregate by race, and they recreate that downtown district. That ordinance is passed, but challenged by a number of African-American madams and prostitutes, and that court case goes to the Louisiana Supreme Court.
Okay.
And I think the number is about 20 madams who are arguing against the case, against the legislation, and they win their court case. So in doing so, it is one of the first successful challenges to Jim Crow era racial segregation laws that I'm aware of. And of course, Plessy versus Ferguson is only about 21 years before that. So we're not much after when Jim Crow has gone into effect across the country. Right after, so I think that's the summer of, it's August maybe, of 1917.
Okay.
And in November of that year, Storyville is shut down entirely. So it doesn't end up having much effect.
Sure.
But it is very interesting to see this successful challenge to Jim Crow as Jim Crow is picking up steam and continues,
right,
you know, as we know, throughout the rest of that decade and much of the remaining century, the first half of the 20th century. So it's a really interesting piece. It's the brief for Willie Piazza, who's okay. one of the madams, and we have a photo of her that ran in the Blue Book, and one of the briefs for her for Sweetie Miller, who was another plaintiff and worked for Lou the White. So you can see that towards the end of the exhibition.
I just think it's an amazing exhibition that really can. I would encourage people to come again to the Historic New Orleans collection, because just in that relatively, it's not a small exhibit, but just in the span of walking through, it does a great job of taking you physically, visually, and through audio of sort of the era. And I was struck again, having done a fair amount of research over the last month or so of Storyville, still how much you can learn there. And it's easy on some level to dismiss it as prostitution, and maybe even to oversimplify and say, and music, but there were so many other nuances, the effect of the military at the end, this idea of challenging Jim Crow, the segregated pieces of it. There's just so much to it. And I think the exhibit really brings that to life.
Thank you, Mark. Yeah,
thank you so much.
Thank you.
I really appreciate Eric and John and Pamela and Eli for you all taking the time to share with our listeners and to share with me about the history of Storyville. We'll put all the notes over at beyondbourbonst.com. We'll put links to the exhibit, certainly to your book, Pamela, and to the HNOC, so people can find out more as they plan their visit to New Orleans.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank y'all. And thanks to you, the listeners. You can find more episodes like this one. We publish every other week, again, at beyondbourbonst.com. You can find us on iTunes, Stitcher, and wherever you get your podcasts. Until next time, laissez le bon temps rouler.
Thanks for listening to the Beyond Bourbon Street podcast. Find us anytime at beyondbourbonst.com.